Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to another edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. A lot to talk about on this episode, as is always the case, seemingly, and we'll begin with Whole Foods Market in a moment. We'll also discuss a few earnings calls, including that from 99 Cents Only and O'Reilly Auto Parts. But again, dominating the news cycle this week, acquisition interest, or at least possible acquisition interest for Whole Foods Market from Albertsons. This all started 2 weeks ago when media outlets reported that JANA Partners, an activist hedge fund founded by Barry Rosenstein, had a significant stake in the Austin, Texas-based organic grocer. After the news came out, shares of the company on Wall Street popped around 10% through the following week, as the company said that they were open, apparently, to exploring strategic alternatives to create more value. And now, Leighton, when you look at this overall dynamic between Whole Foods Market and Albertsons, there's a lot of dots to connect, but if you squint, you can see where news might lead to a connection between the two.
And you could see a lot of excitement with the shareholders, as that 10% pop that you mentioned throughout last week has really kept on with this momentum of news of Albertsons coming in and potentially wanting to buy and take private Whole Foods Market. There is a larger implication here with JANA Partners, as a lot of analysts have speculated that the company may be in it just for a long-term and not a short-term payoff if JANA Partners does, in fact, decide to sell it to a private equity firm. They do have an 8.8% stake in the firm as of now, and the larger operator here we see in Albertsons has been looking for a long time at trying to acquire other grocers into its portfolio. We talked about Sprouts here recently, and overall, you see the shares of Whole Foods have really been lagging over the last 2 years and has not been a great returner as they had for the previous decade. JANA, like other activist players, have now prescribed new board seats, one of them being food writer Mark Bittman of the New York Times. Mark is actually among three total board nominations. So again, it could be more of a restructuring here from JANA Partners, but it does look as though Albertsons is in the running to have a potential bid on Whole Foods Market. Up to now, potential buyers have been limited for Whole Foods Market. It was reportedly looked at that Amazon was interested in buying the grocer, but has since passed. And then Kroger has been around the news outlets for the last few weeks or so. However, their cash position remains a little bit limited as far as their liquidity is concerned. And Kroger, as we all know, over the past few years has been acquiring smaller grocers, so they have been under a larger debt load. JANA has had deals in the past with other grocers, and that is an important fact here. JANA has had deals in the past with other grocers, Safeway being one of note. They were actually sold to Cerberus Capital Management in 2014 through a deal that JANA had put together. And this is interesting because Cerberus, for those very aware here, is actually the whole owner of Albertsons. And so they have a lot of other groceries under their private equity firm. Currently at $37 a share, Whole Foods Market has around a $12 billion market cap. So any deals that come in are going to be a little bit more pricier. And so you look at someone like Kroger, who's in the mix, they don't necessarily have just $12 billion lying around. However, we can't really look into a Cerberus Capital Management and see their assets because they are a private equity firm. So potentially they do have that cash on hand, or at least the ability to leverage a larger transaction like this and create more value for those Whole Foods shareholders.
And when you look at Cerberus Capital Management, they're a firm that is constantly investing in different enterprises. They say they have over $30 billion under management, and this would suggest maybe not a ton of liquidity to access a $12 billion acquisition, or one that's potentially more than that, considering it would likely be at a premium over the share price. Reports, though, have indicated that the privately held grocery chain in Albertsons has approached bankers on the deal, so it wouldn't necessarily be folded into the $30 billion coming from Cerberus or the $30 billion that Cerberus has under total management, perhaps a bankroll deal. And of course, the valuation is something that's in the air. Initial reports had suggested maybe around $40 to $45 per share. Share price is already nearing $40 per share, so it's not going to be at a tremendous premium over what the share price currently is, if it is indeed that high, and it might not be. We're not in on those particular negotiations, and we're not even sure if those particular negotiations are taking place. Now, back in March, we discussed a report from Bloomberg that talked about the Albertsons-Sprouts connection. Sprouts is similar to Whole Foods in terms of size and almost there in terms of store count, but Sprouts seems to be, as we've talked about in the past, a little bit better off operationally now. Their same-store sales aren't shrinking or stagnating like Whole Foods Market, and it seems like overall shareholders have been happier with the performance of Sprouts versus the performance of Whole Foods Market. One analyst went so far as to speculate that there could be, in fact, a merger between the two predominantly organic grocery banners, and perhaps that was the ultimate goal to the strategic alternatives quotes that came out of Whole Foods' camp a couple of weeks ago. This would be interesting, but I think Leighton and I both have some reservations about this deal because there are a lot of common markets, and in fact, there are a lot of Sprouts locations that are within even a couple square miles of Whole Foods markets in the country. Unlike with the Safeway deal, consolidation is unlikely, according to some. A real estate expert was quoted in the Portland Business Journal as saying that Albertsons needs the high price point stores in their general portfolio, so this could be a fit, and that there would be little overlap like there was in prior mergers. So the implication here is that Whole Foods Market would instead kind of operate as its separate wing underneath Albertsons. This analyst went on to assert the fact that there's been so much acquisition in the grocery space that a buyer could really only come from a couple of sources. And this is true. Only pretty much Kroger and Albertsons are thought to have the wherewithal. Leighton talked about the idea of Kroger coming in and purchasing the store chain in Whole Foods Market. But again, Kroger has been involved with so many acquisitions over the past few years. Their cash position has dwindled somewhat, even though they are still profitable and they are still building their capital position. But I think, Leighton, more than anything, this would be a redundancy for Kroger as they are expanding their organic and Whole Foods offerings within their stores, especially their larger footprint marketplace style locations. And they're building out grocerants as well. So this might be more of a redundancy for Kroger. And some might see Kroger as essentially competing with themselves. Now, anytime a deal like this is rumored, just like the Rite Aid Walgreens Boots Alliance deal was rumored to be taking place, and they needed a buyer for some of their stores, Kroger was in on that mix supposedly as well. But so far, Kroger hasn't necessarily been a name that's been mentioned on any larger acquisitions. They seem content right now with scooping up smaller chains and smaller localized chains to fold underneath their banner of already a number of labels and stores on a local basis. So it doesn't seem like this fits Kroger perhaps as much as it might fit another grocer or maybe another company altogether.
I actually live right by a Kroger, and they've revamped their store about two times in the last decade, and they have a larger organic selection and an all-natural selection, and then obviously we talk about their private label selection, Simply Truth, at least for some of their banners, but you see that this larger extension really does infringe upon Sprouts and Whole Foods' space, and in fact, from a footprint perspective, you can see that, at least in my case, a Kroger is actually right across the street from a Sprouts and just a few blocks away from a brand new Whole Foods. And so that really wouldn't make sense. And we talk about consolidation in the market. And you make a very good point about the Safeway deal that Albertsons had closed on a few years ago. You see consolidation out on the coast where they actually had to close several Safeway locations, several notable locations in Oregon, in fact. And so with this, I think there would be a little less of that under a deal with Albertsons. And so by that analyst speculating that there could only really be one or two or three players in total to buy Whole Foods, or at least are in a financial position to do so currently, I think you definitely have to take something like that into consideration. And then when you look at the overall market cap for Whole Foods Market, they're still priced pretty heavily on the optimism side of things. You see a price to earnings ratio around 26 to 27, whereas a very large or mature grocer in Kroger has been trading around the 14, 15, 16 range as far as price to earnings are concerned. And then Whole Foods really hasn't proven out the 365 concept that you and I personally were very bullish on. In fact, full disclosure here, I had actually invested in Whole Foods shares about two and a half years ago when they were near their all-time highs. And as you can imagine, during a long-term position like that, I actually ended up failing in that stock price and ended up selling off recently, thinking that a potential buying opportunity for an Albertsons or a Kroger would only really lead up the stock to around $40 to $45 a share. So I had to cut my losses. But overall, you see that this deal is very interesting in that the overall market in the United States for the grocery sector has been consolidated and the competition is higher than ever. We talk about Target really struggling in the grocery area since Walmart has been competing very heavily on price. And one is to think that for sure affects the deal here with Whole Foods, because Whole Foods isn't the only player now with the organics and all natural selection. Walmart is very privy to what consumers want, and they're in the space, not only to be a sustainable looking grocer, but someone who recognizes that the trends are really favoring the sustainable sourcing of these products. And so I think this is something that consumers are very concerned about, and it's a very real deal. So that really does bring value to the Whole Foods name. However, is someone willing to pay that much of a premium for a grocer that has been struggling in the last few years?
And I think that's exactly the argument to be made here. Is it seems like $40 to $45 a share is a significant premium. And if it's anything below that, would shareholders potentially disapprove of the deal? Again, you mentioned their price to earnings ratios, and that represents a ton of optimism regarding Whole Foods, which is a concept that, while good and functional 3 to 5 years ago, has began to lose some of its luster. We've talked about how Sprouts is doing, but also the constant growth pattern of natural grocers, although they offer a slightly different product mix. And of course, the folding in not only of Kroger, but other larger regional chains. We talked just last year about Hy-Vee building new locations in the upper Midwest, larger locations to contain grocerants and an increased organic selection. But you go above and beyond that to other regional chains and you see very much the same thing. So again, not sure that that optimism is to be had for Whole Foods. And Leighton talking about his story regarding Whole Foods Market stock kind of reminds everyone why we have that disclaimer not to take our advice on investing in any stocks, that's for sure.
Yeah, I ended up losing quite a bit of money on that deal. Well, we transition with that to an earnings story as earnings season has kicked off again, this time with O'Reilly Auto Parts. This starts us off with overall positive news despite lowered same-store sales. We preface with the fact that O'Reilly has not only been one of the best operators in the auto parts retail sector in North America, but in retail as a whole, as they marry their online presence with a great buy online, pick up in store option now, and they have a growing brick and mortar base that is actually quite large now. They were actually number two on our list for retail operators in 2016. This was actually the last time we discussed them on the Retail Focus podcast, but the reasons for that, they sported very strong same-store sales numbers in nearly all of 2016. They nearly doubled their cash position for the first 9 months in fiscal year 2016, and shares were up 250% over the last 3 years at the end of last year. And they had obvious increases in top line revenue by nearly 8% in fiscal year 2016 over 2015. So, could their momentum increase in their latest quarter? Well, the answer is a little bit mixed, Trent. Their first quarter fiscal year 2017 results are here. The release came out on Wednesday, April 26th, before the conference call of the morning of Thursday, April 27th, which was actually a little bit unique. They ended up delaying the conference call one whole day. Perhaps the biggest disappointment that I had alluded to was that same-store sales miss in their earnings release, coming in at just 0.8% for the quarter. This was below reduced guidance of 2 to 4% increases, and those 2 to 4% increases were actually a little bit lower than we had been seeing over the course of last year. And they had cited that they had a mild January that affected sales throughout that month. And then a lot of increased volatility due to weather in the winter. They had a heavy amount of things like de-icers that didn't sell through. And you're seeing a much more mild winter over the last few years. And so I think they, one, could have probably forecasted that. But then two, you have to think logically, Trent, when the weather's a bit warmer outside, a lot more people are going to be working on their cars and doing those household cleaning types of things that would affect a business like O'Reilly's Auto Parts. They did, however, set two company records, so I don't mean to be too pessimistic here. One in top-line revenue and another in earnings per diluted share. Top-line sales increased by 3% or $60 million to $2.16 billion. This was $2.1 billion this time last year, and increased almost entirely attributable to new store openings because of that lacking same-store sales metric. Gross profit in terms of cash also went up by 3%, but fell slightly as a percent of revenue if you compare it to this time last year, and so did selling, general, and administrative expenses, as those fell to 33.8% of sales. This was 32.4% of sales last year. So again, a mixed bag for O'Reilly's Auto Parts.
And you talked about the potential volatility in same-store sales numbers brought about by a mild January, or what they cited as a mild January. It's always incumbent upon people to check out earnings reports from other retailers in the same sector to see exactly how much weather did, in fact, affect them. And AutoZone, who was in the same boat as O'Reilly, a lot of solid same-store sales results last year. They actually showed a pretty weak January as well in the quarter, including January. They were flat. Advance Auto Parts has not released earnings, including that January period, so we're yet to see how Advance Auto Parts had their top-line revenue and their same-store sales impacted in January. Back to some of the earnings details for O'Reilly. Their earnings per share went up to $2.83 per share from $2.59 per share. This despite a decrease in operating income from $419 million to $403 million. So their operating income went down. Their earnings per share went up and actually set a record for the company. How did that happen? Well, there are a couple of different things at play here. First, they repurchased 6 million shares in the year since their first quarter fiscal year 2016 results came out about 12 months ago, due in large part to their increased cash position and dedication to returning shareholder value. We've talked about how their sales have been so strong over the past year. They've returned some of that value to the shareholders through the share repurchasing plan. So they only have about 93 million shares out now versus 99 million shares out 1 year ago. So if we adjust for the number of shares that are out, their EPS would look a little bit more like $2.66 per share instead of $2.83 per share. It's about a 17-cent impact, and this is something, honestly, we don't talk a lot about on the show when it comes to earnings per share numbers. In this case, we can see that it made a real impact. Second, they adopted this new share-based compensation accounting standard during the first quarter. They say this requires whatever excess tax benefits from share-based compensation payments to be recorded in the income statement. So bottom line, to simplify, they got a 23 cent per share benefit from this. So if you take into account the reduced number of shares on the marketplace and also this 23 cent per share benefit from the new accounting standard, their earnings per share look a lot more like $2.43. So a little bit less, in fact, by about 16 cents from where it was standing at the same time last year. Part of me wonders if they adopted this new accounting standard to maybe make their EPS look a little bit better this year, especially after such a solid campaign last year. But management was pretty transparent about adopting the new accounting standard and about the impacts it caused on the earnings per share front. So one would think that it's probably not intentional, at least for the purpose of churning out larger numbers, which sometimes, every now and again, we see companies adopt weird accounting practices for earnings per share. Now, looking ahead for O'Reilly Auto Parts, feeling confident that whatever plagued their first quarter is behind them, including that mild January, they're maintaining same-store sales guidance of 3-5% for the full year. That would be a 3-5% increase. And they're also establishing 3-5% same-store sales increase expectations for the second quarter. So they're keeping everything else right on target with where it was to begin the year. In this release that they produced with the earnings call, they allude to the spring sales season being underway, and apparently it's strong so far, strong enough to maintain their current forecast for the year at large. They wanted earnings per share last quarter to be about $2.78 to $2.88 without the 23 cent per share benefit caused by that new accounting standard. However, they expect full year operating profit, despite the miss in the last quarter, to end up at about 20.1 to 20.5% of sales, much higher than the 18.7% of sales mark they reached in the first quarter that has just passed. Greg Hensley, their CEO, said the weather that we've cited in January created mixed headwinds that hurt their margins, basically saying here that their cold weather seasonal products that they carry and sell a lot of during these severe wintry January and February months carried a higher margin than what they actually ended up selling during that time. Additionally, despite having the same inventory turnover as last year, their inventory per store actually went up in this most recent quarter from $584,000 of inventory per store in the same period last year to $588,000 per store in the first quarter this year. Full year earnings per share they expect will be right around $12.05 to $12.15. They're expecting for the second quarter $3.10 to $3.20 in earnings per share, and they are retaining full year total revenue guidance. All of this meaning positive things overall for O'Reilly, and this kind of telegraphs the fact that they actually do think that the first quarter was caused by weather headwinds and not by some other reason. Typically, when retailers blame weather for something and it's not actually forced by weather, rather it's an underlying cause within their organization, they will decrease full year guidance, and we're not seeing that here with O'Reilly. Perhaps playing into that, some of the new store openings they have planned.
Yeah, if you look at those store openings, you can see that management is bullish despite some of those weather headwinds and other factors that plagued for the first quarter of 2017. But you see, in that quarter, they opened 60 stores. This compares to just 52 stores in the first quarter of 2016. So you can actually see an acceleration of growth as far as total unit count. Overall, in the last year, since the first quarter earnings call of 2016, they've opened 220 stores and acquired 48. They only closed 3 stores during the same time span, and net new stores, therefore, sit around 265 over the last 12 months. So just a very bullish brick-and-mortar retailer. We're talking about stories now where they're claiming, where media outlets are claiming that retail is dead. This is certainly not one of the operators that is struggling. This represents about a 6% increase in overall store count, only closing, again, 3 stores for the chain with 4,888 stores currently. Massive success for their brick and mortar. And one thing that really sets their real estate apart is that they have no need to be in high traffic retail districts, instead focusing their stores around residential areas near to the people that they serve. They are like grocery stores almost in that regard. And this is an interesting business, Trent, because we were talking about this off the air before recording, but this is a business that really has focused more on their online presence. And this is extremely important because me personally, I just bought an air filter for a car, and you could see that from a competitive pricing standpoint, Amazon really has infringed upon their space. In fact, Amazon was actually the most competitive and the best price that I could find for my particular car's air filter. So I think this is extremely important that they do put that operating capital into their online infrastructure going forward. But overall, you can see that there is a bullish sentiment from company management, not only increasing the capital expenditures, but then also increasing those store counts that I just talked about. And one might ask, where is that demand coming from? Why is the company so bullish? Well, in 2016, the IHS market study said that the average car's age in the United States was 11.6 years old. This versus 11.5 in 2015. And then if you go all the way back to 2002, to put this in more relative terms, the average age for a car in the United States was approximately 9.6 years old. So obviously, logically thinking here, the older the car, the more maintenance, the more common maintenance things you're going to have to do to the car. So O'Reilly's Auto Parts obviously looking at those older cars and supplying things like alternators, but obviously they look at things too, like car batteries, light bulbs, things that are more general maintenance specific. So additionally, and perhaps more importantly, car registrations for light vehicles or consumer vehicles increased 2.4% over that same time period, which doesn't really sound like a lot, Trent, but that represents 6 million more vehicles on the road that might need some little fixes here and there. So for O'Reilly's, now is the time to grow, perhaps, because that car count is increasing overall. And you see that in 2017, the total amount of cars on the road will reach 265 million, and new car sales for the end of 2016 actually reached an all-time high. So all of this together really means big business for these auto parts retailers.
So, Leighton, all of that, the additional number of cars on the road and the increased age of the cars on the road, seems to suggest that this particular sector of retail is filled with opportunity, but shareholders don't really see it that way, which is interesting. And perhaps the market doesn't see enough long-term potential to really drive the price-to-earnings ratio up for O'Reilly. In fact, after this earnings announcement, their shares fell 3% on Thursday, April 27th, to $257 per share. They're basically flat for the trailing 52 weeks, despite those same-store sales numbers that we mentioned all throughout last year being so strong. This was a company we were really bullish on during 2016, especially the middle portion of the last year, but it is down from its July 2016 all-time high of $290 per share. Still a little bit on the optimistic side with a price-to-earnings ratio of 24, but when you see a company expand like this without contracting, without needing to close as many stores because they are confident in their real estate and brick-and-mortar portfolio, there's perhaps an argument to be made that maybe the market is still underpricing O'Reilly, especially given their continued commitment to repurchasing shares and giving dividends back to their shareholders. We move on to an additional earnings call, this from a company not publicly traded but in the private sector. 99 Cents Only Stores continues to suggest momentum in the true dollar store sector with massive same-store sales increases in their fourth quarter. This is for them, their fourth quarter fiscal 2017 that they're giving out earnings for. So they're operating kind of one fiscal year ahead of everyone, at least in terms of number. However, the bigger thing for the company and the bigger thing to take away from this earnings report, they still lost money overall in the quarter, although not nearly as much as they lost in last year's fourth quarter. To give you a little background, because they're not a business we discuss a lot on the show, 99 Cents Only, as far as we're concerned, is a true dollar store. While they don't hold all their prices underneath a dollar, we've talked at length before about how operators like Dollar General and Family Dollar are more glorified C stores or convenience stores without gas, or even glorified variety stores, as they don't necessarily adhere to any strict pricing structure. We would compare 99 Cents Only more to Dollar Tree, whose entire selection is $1, or to Five Below, who have all of their prices underneath $5, which is kind of more the scheme that 99 Cents Only uses, as they do have a few products that are over that $1 mark. 99 Cents Only, though, is not as large as their Dollar Tree brethren, nor even as large as the ever-growing Five Below. They actually had net negative store openings in the fourth quarter that we're covering the earnings for. Negative 4 stores, in fact. They closed 5 stores and opened 1. However, this is a shrewd approach from the company, because all 5 stores were closed when their leases expired, so they didn't have to pay to break the leases from these underperforming locations. During the same time, if you want a basis for comparison, Five Below actually opened their first 9 California stores. So potentially 99 Cents Only may have their market share crunched a little bit in the future. Again, to kind of describe the store, if you're unfamiliar, they are highly regional. Most of their locations are on the West Coast or in the Southwest, California, Nevada, ranging on to Dallas, which is about as far east as they go. Their sales run about $5.2 million per store, average square footage of around 16,000, which is pretty substantial in this sector. Now that we've given you the background to these stores, Leighton, why don't you talk about some of the results for the company?
Yeah, and we talk about results here, and this is interesting because the company is very bullish on disclosure, but they were actually taken private in January 13th of 2012. They were a previously traded company, and before that, they were a family-run business. But we go to the numbers, and we see that What was potentially most impressive was the growth in net sales, Trent, up 6.7% to $552.5 million. This despite the negative net stores that you had talked about. Again, negative 4 stores for the quarter overall. They did benefit from the expansion in prior quarters, but it was limited compared to most companies in a growth stage. Same store sales got a 6.4% boost, and that's really the number we want to focus on and highlight here, as this puts them towards the top of all brick and mortar retailers for whom we've covered earnings for in this past year or in this past quarter. We just got done talking about O'Reilly's that had a 0.8% increase, a company that had had previous success in this metric. Their CEO, Jeffrey Covert, noted that this was from the basket size increasing up 4.4%, as well as transaction count. So that's the 1-2 punch we're looking for as far as same store sales. A lot of companies here recently have only been increasing the overall basket size, as the transaction count has been down for some retailers. Their gross margin exploded to 30.1% of sales from 26.7% in the prior year's fourth quarter. Their CEO said this was a result of reducing shrink and scrap at their stores, and also what he called execution in their logistics network. And shrink does tend to be a bit tough in these places. It's amazing that this reduction was this notable here and really improved their gross margin by such a large margin. But you see that shrink is something that you don't really see companies focused on with these dollar stores, is a lot of less rigid inventory measures are taken than that of, say, a Walmart or a Target. You're looking at products that are worth a little bit less than your high dollar items like TVs and other electronic items. So overall, less of a focus in the long term for dollar stores when it comes to inventory structure. But for all of this positive, they are still struggling on the bottom line. They lost more money than the previous year, with a net loss of $20.9 million versus $18.4 million in the prior year. As you see, again, strong sales, at least for the full year and this last quarter. What could they be looking at to improve their bottom line?
We mentioned the strong sales for the full year, up 2.9%. Their same store sales for the full year, up 2.1%. And even their margin was up, and they were able to reduce their net loss. But you're right, Leighton. Looking ahead, it seems as though they need to maybe trim back on some things or execute on a few different strategies before they can return to profitability. Now, in order to analyze this fully, I wanted to compare them to two of the other businesses in this sector. Dollar Tree, which fortunately breaks out their numbers separate from Family Dollar, which is also held in their portfolio, and Five Below, which, as we've covered before, is a smaller chain than Dollar Tree, but they are continually growing. I wanted to look at the three chains' cost of sales, or basically cost of goods sold in most cases. For their fourth quarter, for 99-cent stores, they were 69.9% of sales. So their cost of sales cost about 70% of the top-line revenue. To their credit, that was down from 73.3% in the prior year's fourth quarter, which was even worse. So I wanted to see how this compared to others in the sector. For Dollar Tree, separated from Family Dollar, it was 62.5% in the latest quarter, and for the year, 64.6%. Now, a side note, Family Dollar is around 74%, which pushes Dollar Tree as a company up around the 68% range, but still 62.5% in the latest quarter for Dollar Tree, compared to about 70% for 99-cent stores. For Five Below in their latest quarter, the cost of goods sold was 58.9%, and for the year, 64.3%. Our takeaway from this, their margins are roughly in eyesight of Dollar Tree, but they still have a long way to go, and what's more is their margins are far lower than Five Below, which is in a growth stage. So this is a major danger sign for them, in that what they are selling costs more for them to bring in than it does for their competitors. I have a couple of theories on this, but one of them lies in economies of scale. Because they only have 390 locations, they're unable to keep up with companies like Five Below, who are constantly growing, who can broker a bit better deals on the distributor and supplier front. So things in this regard are only going to get worse for them unless they can somehow make better use of economies of scale, which they can either do by opening up more locations, by making capital expenditures to open up more locations, or simply by moving more product in the stores themselves. The other thing that I wanted to look at was their selling, general, and administrative expenses compared to these other outlets. In the fourth quarter, they were $172.6 million, or to put in percentage of sales terms, 31.2% of sales. That you can tell already, you have selling, general, and administrative expenses and their cost of goods sold adding up to more than 100%, which for a business is never good. That implies that you're losing money. For the year, it was 31.7% of sales. Go back to Five Below. For the last quarter, $80.6 million or 20.8% of sales, so significantly down from where it is for 99-cent only stores. For the year, it's 24% of sales. For Dollar Tree, 21% of sales in the last quarter. For the year, 22% of sales. So our takeaway here, they need to do something to trim the SG&A expenses at this organization. Maybe trimming leadership positions, maybe trimming administrative positions. The other thing you can do, though, is because you have this higher capacity due to this massive amount of administration, you could build out your store count. Because your gross margins are low and your SG&A is high, that all suggests that you've got a lot of room. You've got a lot of ceiling under which to work, so you can add stores in the existing infrastructure, help out in terms of your cost of goods sold, helping also to decrease your selling, general, and administrative expenses as a percent of sales as you continue to add other store options. Now, they obviously don't want to extend too far outside their current footprint, but you look at Colorado, New Mexico, Oregon, these are wide open for them, and they've also been relatively untapped by Five Below, so this would help them reap those benefits we talk about from economies of scale. Alternatively, if they're dead set on only expanding slightly each year, they are looking ahead to opening only 3 stores during this next fiscal year. Did not note any possible closures coming for the company. They could trim distribution expenses and almost certainly administrative expenses by consolidating districts within their store's organization. The numbers show that they have a very high ceiling, as I already talked about, in terms of folding additional stores in underneath their current administration, but their current staffing and administration levels are far beyond what a single-digit gain in same-store sales from their current stores could actually fix. So they've got a lot of work to do, even though they've cut down a lot of their losses towards profitability. And they're trying to do this a little bit further through some of their existing initiatives, which has pushed their guidance up a little bit for the next year.
Yeah, and you spoke very well about how they have a lot of open space here domestically as far as opening potential new stores in existing markets where they don't have a lot of penetration. But we have seen their grand opening events, and you and I actually were talking about this off air and how we like them because they use a lot of strong branding. They talk about the number 9. Obviously, it's in their name, but the number 9 shows up predominantly in their promotions and these store openings. At the Montebello, California store that they opened in February, they sold 9. 32-inch flat screen LED TVs for just 99 cents to the first 9 customers in line. In this case, the next 99 customers in line on the second day of sales could purchase a scooter for 99 cents, with the next 99 able to purchase then a coffee maker, and then the next 99 a toaster. So again, obviously this is something that they carry through other marketing campaigns, but this is something that they could really use in order to get some brand awareness in some newer areas if they were going to open some new stores. But Trent, it's a little tough to open new locations, obviously, when your gross margins are struggling so much. And one thing that I wanted to look at is, obviously, gross margins is a function of cost of goods sold, and that with a dollar store is a bit tough when you're seeing inflation increase, and that's something that we wanted to touch on briefly here. And since they are hamstrung by around that $1 price point, their cost of goods will be tied more into the inflation metric. And for the United States in 2016, inflation, which is based on the consumer price index, hit 2.07%, which isn't that bad. That's actually within the Federal Reserve's target inflationary metric. But if you look at the expected range for 2017, that number is going to be a little bit higher for retailers. We're looking that just in the 2 months, January and February, year-to-date numbers show that inflation was already up 0.9%. Trent, that would indicate that increased inflation will potentially hit 3% for the full calendar year of 2017. And for a business that's dependent on being able to buy their products very cheaply in order to get as much margin as possible at their own very cheap price point, it is extremely important to pay attention to that number. And Trent, as you had mentioned, economies of scale really come into play here. Obviously, they could get a little bit more buying power if they did extend their store base. So a lot of things to keep an eye on here. And I am glad at least that we have these numbers to go off of, because again, the company is a private one and it is a very interesting company because there's not many like it that are as large as it is.
Today's Retail Focus episode is brought to you by Path to Purchase Leadership University. Path to Purchase success relies on understanding shopper behavior, but finding time for training can be a challenge. That's why Path to Purchase Leadership University created a collection of online courses to enhance your knowledge on topics like shopper marketing, e-commerce, collaboration, and more. Path to Purchase Leadership University is the only end-to-end online and on-demand curriculum that builds shopper-centric knowledge and skills. So don't wait. Enroll at p2pi.org/learn. That's p2pi.org/learn.
Path to Purchase success relies on understanding shoppers, their behaviors, and collective shopper experience. That's why Path to Purchase Leadership University has developed an industry-specific curriculum designed to make you an expert in your role. These online, on-demand courses cover shopper marketing, shopper behavior, and engagement, e-commerce, collaboration, insights, and more.
You can also choose a more robust and challenging course of study to earn an industry designation that demonstrates your achievements and skill level to peers and competitors. Path to Purchase Leadership University is the only end-to-end, online, and on-demand training program that builds shopper-centric knowledge and skills. So once again, don't wait. Become more shopper-centric. Enroll today at p2pi.org/learn. That's p2pi.org/learn.
We're back with another earnings report. This was Super Values. They reported earnings that caused an escalation in its stock price this week, despite some obvious areas of weakness in particular, their grocery retail sector. The grocery retail and wholesale distributor reported fourth quarter results on Tuesday. From the numbers side of things, it is easy to see why shares of the company popped initially by about 6.8%. Earnings per share came in at 13 cents for the quarter, beating analyst expectations of 9 cents, which is a very large beat on the profit side of things. However, if you look year over year, Trent, earnings per share did fall 7% from the fourth quarter in 2016. They also beat on revenue, but by a much lesser margin than they beat on profit. Revenue from all the operations, wholesale and retail combined, came in at $2.91 billion, beating average analyst estimates by $10 million. Revenue was up 0.6% year over year, so you can see that the business is at least growing. And gross profit was 15% of sales, up 10 basis points due to vendor leverage and reduced shrink. Shrink, obviously, a number we had just got done talking about with 99-cent stores. Selling, general, and administrative expenses as a percentage of sales were a bit more due to wage inflation, that nasty wage inflation that has been hitting not only the general merchandise retail sectors, but restaurants as well, something we talk about in the Food Focus podcast often. The company has been paying down debt, which is a good sign, as they had promised they would. They've been using a portion of the proceeds from the Save-A-Lot divestment. We had talked about that deal. The Save-A-Lot deal garnered the company $1.37 billion. And overall, Trent, we look at the segments, we split them up into wholesale and retail. It is very obvious that one side of things is doing much better than the other.
Wholesale is having that sparkling success. And in a recent episode, Super Value's also been in the news quite a bit. We spoke of their $375 million offer to buy Unified Grocers, which is a West Coast co-op food distributor. And when you look at how well the wholesale division has done for Super Value, you see why this business might make sense, or this business acquisition for them. As for the most recent quarter, the Super Value wholesale business's revenue expanded by 3% to $1.79 billion. They cited new outlets from existing customers for this increase. Operating margin growth also came in up 70 basis points. This is something that should, in theory, keep expanding as they accomplish greater economies of scale, something we talked about during the 99-cent store story. There will also be a learning curve benefit in the long term as they acquire knowledge of different products and how they are produced. For example, Unified Grocers has a product mix that extends far beyond what Super Value currently offers. But what I wanted to focus on really was the retail division results. Something Leighton talked about at the end of the Food Focus episode earlier this week was the near-perfect opposite sales contraction in their retail business from their wholesale division, where wholesale sales were up 3% for Super Value. Retail sales fell 3.2% compared to that growth. Total retail sales came in at $1.07 billion, so we see here that roughly one-third of Super Value's business is now comprised of retail, far below where it was even a couple of years ago. I think the big red light and siren is their same-store sales figures. Their losses of 5.8% for stores open at least a year, certainly a warning sign. Their traffic was down 4.3%. Average basket also down, which has been pretty common for grocery and food retailers in this climate of food deflation. The effect for food deflation was about 1%, so realistically, their average basket size about even with the same quarter last year. All of this caused their net margin to dwindle, down 140 basis points to just 1.3% of sales. To put this in perspective, Kroger had a net margin of 1.8% for their fourth quarter. Furthermore, if you compare this to the 3.6% net margin from wholesale operations, it's no wonder why the company has formed a different strategy, putting their eggs in that wholesale basket. But Leighton, this is something I really did want to focus on above and beyond the retail store earnings numbers. The fact that potentially they are reviewing their store portfolio and maybe looking for strategic alternatives for some of these stores, and now they've got to try and rush to get some of these stores performing better so they can appear at least like a better buy to a company that might swoop in and purchase them, and so that they can demand a higher price for their grocery store operations as compared to just selling off underperforming stores at essentially a bargain price.
Yeah, and you mentioned some very good points here in that wholesale has been extremely strong, but not only do they have products that they sell to grocers and retail outlets throughout the country, but they also have services. These accompanying services obviously carry heftier margins, which helps boost those net margins. And you talked about them hitting 3.6% net margin from wholesale operations. So this is definitely something they're looking forward to as far as an overall strategy for the company and a longstanding strategy that was looking to be very profitable. But you look at retail, it's not going away anytime soon. Super Value is looking to invest in at least two of its banners. We talk about it has several banners under the company, but Cub Foods and Hornbacher's are two brands and banners that they see as very valuable to the company and they hope to keep in house. However, their CEO, Mark Gross, did allude to some possible strategic alternatives and said they will be reviewing their store portfolio, like you had said. Food Lion stores have been converted to Shop and Save, and those stores, Trent, have been disappointing in terms of store sales and same store sales. And so I think by looking at that store portfolio, they will be looking specifically at those Shop and Save banners to potentially sell to some existing wholesale customers. And that can do one of two things, Trent. One, it can unlock value for them overall. You see that with the previous divestments, it really unlocks a lot of cash, and they have nearly $2 billion in debt, and it's going to be not a good sign for them on the balance sheet if that continues to be a burden. But overall, the number two thing you can look at as far as being able to benefit from a potential Shop and Save divestment is the ability to have contracts thereafter. So they're talking about selling to potential retail wholesale customers. And if you sell these locations to existing customers, you've already formed these relationships and you can take advantage of those relationships by being able to sell some of your private label merchandise and some other products to them, maybe forming some long-term contracts. But the company did say they are open to opening some new Hornbacher's and Cub Foods locations. So that's good, at least for those banners. Overall, shares of Super Value are trading around $4.15 per share. And to put this in perspective, that means they're down 25% from this time last year. So even though the shares pop, Trent, on this positive wholesale news and the overall potential of selling part of the retail portfolio, you still see pessimism in the market as the company still only carries a $1.15 billion market cap.
We conclude our news section of the Retail Focus podcast with a company we haven't covered in nearly a year, Barnes & Noble is changing leadership yet again. We'll get to that in a second. They're also closing one of their largest locations in terms of sales in the U.S. in their downtown Minneapolis location. That's what we'll talk about first. This weekend will be the last for the longstanding downtown location on the Nicollet Mall. This is actually a location I visited about a year and a half ago on a visit to the Twin Cities area. Now, Nicollet Mall, a very popular shopping district in Minneapolis. This location's been in business since 1994. It's survived the company's struggles to this point and the previous downsizing efforts. And this location is unique in that although it does drive pretty good sales per square foot, it is a relatively small location. The layout has 11,000 feet on the main floor and 14,000 square feet on the second floor. Now, the average size of a Barnes & Noble is slightly above that at 26,000 square feet, but their locations can be as large as 60,000 square feet. Amazon's five bookstores, for comparison, range about 5,000 to 6,000 square feet, so certainly seeing a movement towards a smaller square footage location, and Barnes & Noble is actually capitalized on that type of setup. They have a few smaller 3,000 square foot locations in some parts of the country as they try to reduce their size of their stores. The regional implication is certainly negative as this Nicollet Mall saw one of their anchors in Macy's exit at the beginning of the year, although as a whole, this mall is, like I said, bustling every time you go down there. It's in a burgeoning area of downtown Minneapolis, not far away from the new U.S. Bank Stadium and a major convention district downtown. They've been undergoing a large construction process, actually. It's been going on for nearly a year and won't be completed until this fall. And business owners have actually been complaining that this may have affected traffic numbers there. A lot of overhead walkways because there is snow on the ground much of the year in Minneapolis, at least compared to other areas of the U.S. And the overhead walkways also serve to let customers go over street traffic, but a lot of these had been under construction, and in fact, there was a lot of construction there when, once again, I was there a year and a half ago. Local news has stated that there are some discounts on merchandise, but not all of the merchandise. Much of it will likely be distributed to the other 12 Barnes & Noble Twin Cities locations. A mix of 20 part and full-time employees have been given the opportunity to be absorbed in the other locations as well. And it seems like customers overall kind of saddened by this news, as it is a large marker for Barnes & Noble to be leaving this location after so many years there. But in much larger news, as far as implications for the company, they've acquired new leadership.
Demos Panernos is the new CEO for the company. He will be actually the fourth CEO in 4 years, really showing how the company has faced a lot of struggles amid online competition. You had mentioned the online brick and mortar presence from Amazon creating those five retail stores, but their online sales have been boosted over the past several years, and Barnes & Noble has a strong e-commerce platform. However, leadership has seen falling same-store sales over the last few quarters, and they really do need a change. Leonard Riggio lasted less than a year. He was CEO since August 2016. He's actually been with the company for about 4 decades, and it really was just a placeholder for the most recent loss of their previous CEO, Ron Boer, who was their CEO from 2015 to August 2016. So Riggio, again, a lot of experience with the company, and he had actually ended up having to postpone retirement to try to lead the company in a correct direction and to try to acquire some new leadership for the company so that the company can sustain growth throughout the next few years, or at least sustain their stance in the market. But we talked about the same-store sales drop this last holiday season, which should be the biggest for a retailer such as Barnes & Noble. Same-store sales dropped 9%, but this, again, not for a lack of trying. It's overall in the management's best interest over the past few months to really bring life into this company, bring new life into this company. You can see that potentially closing that one location may be a sign that they're looking to have more locations closed, but overall, you see that they do still have a very large presence in brick and mortar in the United States, nearly 640 brick and mortar stores overall. And if you look at the operations, they really really haven't received as much respect as they may deserve. Over the last decade, you see a lot of closures, one being important here in Borders, as they had shuttered their doors years ago. But the upscale concept stores that we had discussed earlier last year seem to be doing okay, as they plan on opening four of those this year. They, of course, feature the wine and upscale food offerings and are a little bit smaller in footprint, which should save them on the overhead. But this is something that Amazon's bookstores will probably not be doing. So we talk about competitive advantage. How can they differentiate from just being a plain old bookseller with a Starbucks location to being a destination for customers? And they already do carry a strong brand awareness. So I am curious to see if they leverage that more and if those four additional smaller locations are going to be profitable for them in the years to come. In March, the company did confirm that they would be keeping their quarterly dividend at 15 cents per share. So that was good news for shareholders. And they were also re-energized on the news of a 50 million share purchase program. And so I think this share repurchasing and the dividend is just a reassertion to their current shareholders that they are still focused on returning that long-term value. But overall, you see that the publicly traded firm, ticker BKS, the shares are down 26% for the rolling year, currently at around $8.80 per share. They carry a market cap of around $645 million. Me personally, I think they could be valued a bit more, if not only because of their brick and mortar presence. We talk about those assets being extremely valuable as you see commercial real estate prices only going up year over year.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, and as we do every week in this space, we tell you about a story we're keeping an eye on that'll unfold over the next week or couple of weeks, and we begin with Leighton.
So this is a story that we were talking about including on this edition of the Retail Focus, but we just didn't have time because of all the other news stories and earnings news. But this comes from Under Armour, as they had recently reported their first quarter earnings results, and shares took off nearly 10% in trading on Thursday. And this is a company that we had talked about during the last quarter and how they've been hemorrhaging money due to a lot of capital expenditures. We talk about a lot of involvement in tech and a lot of involvement in endorsements. Obviously, the Steph Curry deal and the Jordan Spieth deal come to mind, but they had remarked some interesting things during this latest quarter in that they actually lost less money than expected. The company lost 1 cent per share. But the thing I wanted to focus on here briefly is the Steph Curry series shoe underperformed, and that's been actually a trend for the company. And they said they look to be investing a little bit more money in the basketball sector, and that it's really been a learning experience for the company. Their management was extremely transparent, and that's always something you like to see in a publicly traded company, is really opening up about your opportunities. And I think the shoe and footwear category for the company is certainly an opportunity going forward. Nike, obviously one of the biggest players in the market. If they look to take any more market share from Nike, they're going to have to perform a little bit better. And so I look forward to them potentially beating on earnings in the future quarters in 2017 and potentially using that cash to invest in those more opportunistic areas.
The story I'm looking ahead to actually ties into our second story of this episode about O'Reilly's Auto Parts. Coming up in early May, they haven't released an actual date yet, but it should be around or on May 11th. Advance Auto Parts will be releasing their earnings report for the first quarter of fiscal year 2017. And part of the reason I'm looking ahead to this, one is to see if they can continue momentum in comparative store sales from their previous quarter of positive 3.1%. Keep in mind that they also just completed an acquisition of a smaller auto parts retailer, but also to see if the story that AutoZone and O'Reilly's is telling regarding the mild January is true, and if these affect the Advance Auto Parts numbers negatively. If so, we can then look to potentially a positive second quarter for all of these companies, or what for AutoZone would be their third quarter. Either way, a solid next period for all three of these companies if Advance comes out with slightly worse earnings. And that seems counterintuitive, but I'm just anxious to see what they have to say about the weather and where their margins come in during this next period. Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Check us out on Twitter at Retail Podcast. You can always reach out to us, retailpodcast@gmail.com. Again, today's episode has been brought to you by the Path to Purchase Leadership University. We'll be back with Food Focus next week.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.